Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, February 11th. Don't mess with energy. Top congressmen turn up heat on administration's energy policies. The story was written by Mela McEwen. Three congressmen braved Midland's freezing cold Wednesday to turn up the heat on the Biden administration's energy policies. Congressman August Pfluger, whose 11th district includes Midland and Odessa, was joined by House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy of California and House Natural Resources Committee ranking member Bruce Westerman of Arkansas to tour a Diamondback Energy drilling rig. Following the tour, Pfluger told media there was one message from the tour, quote, "Don't mess with Texas, don't mess with our jobs, don't mess with our livelihoods, don't mess with our energy independence," end quote. Without what those on the drilling rig behind him do, Pfluger said, quote, "This nation would be cold, dark, and hungry," end quote. "What those on that drilling rig and others like it have done," he continued, "is lift a billion people around the globe out of poverty by providing access to reliable, affordable, clean energy." McCarthy decried the fact that, with the stroke of a pen signing executive orders to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline, President Biden has eliminated 1 million jobs that included not only the union workers involved with the pipeline, but ancillary jobs at hotels and restaurants. In the Permian Basin, he said the moratorium on oil and gas leasing and drilling permits on federal lands would result in lost jobs and housing foreclosures. Replacing them, quote, with solar panels doesn't add up, he said. Quote, "What's worse is it makes our adversaries stronger and us less safe," he said, adding that it puts money in the pockets of adversaries while costing U.S. jobs. Beyond the jobs, McCarthy said, it is an issue of affordability because the cost of energy is part of the price of everything consumers buy. Westerman commented that while the moratorium on federal lands does not directly impact Texas as it does New Mexico, quote, "You better believe they're coming after you," end quote. He also noted that domestic energy has its environmental benefits. Quote, "We all breathe the air, we all drink the water. All of us want clean air, clean water, and to make the environment better. Conservation comes from conservative, and a real conservative means being a good steward of our resources. We can have a clean environment and a strong economy. They're not mutually exclusive," end quote. The three called on President Biden to reinstate the Keystone XL pipeline and lift the moratorium on oil and gas activity on federal lands. McCarthy said there were a number of bills proposed, including one by Pfluger, to support oil and gas activity, and he called on Democrats to join Republicans in supporting the industry and its efforts to provide reliable, affordable, plentiful energy with a lower environmental footprint than nations that would be expected to supply energy to the U.S. City officials say extension of downtown hotel deal is likely. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. The building of a luxury downtown hotel in downtown Midland is on hold, but still very much alive. Instead, both Spencer Robnett and Scott Dufford have told a reporter Telegram that the Western United Life building in the 300 block of Texas Street will be demolished and an extension of the city's deal with the Midway Companies, a development group out of Houston, is likely to keep plans on track for the building of a four-star hotel in the future. Both have told the reporter Telegram in recent weeks that tough economic times across the nation and in Midland have created inevitable delays to the project, which was to use the current Western United Life Building and create a 205-room hotel across the street from Centennial Park and down the street from the Bush Convention Center. However, both Robnett and Dufford have stated the expectation is the project will continue in some form. First, the city will concentrate on demolishing the Western United Life Building, no matter the eventual fate of the hotel deal. Robnett had told the reported Telegram the hotel deal timeline always called for a full abatement of the Western United Life Building. Once that takes place, it is now expected the building will be demolished. The combination of such will start the clock on Midway fulfilling a laundry list of requirements to move forward, including proof of financing. Dufford and Robnett said developers will build a new 150 to 160 key hotel. The incentives will be similar to the previous agreement from in 2019, minus the cost from the demolition. The original deal, approved by the council, included $20 million, $15 million in cash incentives paid to Midway, and $5 million expended by the Midland Development Corporation to purchase and remediate the Western United Life Building. The Midland City Council also provided $8 million at the time to build a 400-space parking garage. Another part of the overall deal with Midway also included a pair of abatement packages with the City of Midland. The city is expected to abate ad valorem property taxes and hotel occupancy taxes for a period of 10 years, contingent upon the project's cost, according to the current deal in place. When the council approved the hotel deal in 2019, Midway officials had said there would be a ballroom and meeting space of approximately 14,000 square feet on land formerly occupied by the building of the Southwest, which has been demolished. The finished hotel project also will include ground floor retail and restaurant space of approximately 10,000 square feet, according to previous Reporter Telegram articles. Quote, Midway does not want to give up on the project, Dufford told the Reporter Telegram. We want to put in a nice product in that everyone will be proud of. That is what I envision, end quote. In the interim, Dufford expects a parking lot to be put into place where the Western United Life Building currently stands until construction of the hotel begins. West Texas is on track to get even more nuclear waste. A hazardous waste disposal company in Andrews County wants to handle more dangerous levels of nuclear waste. Federal agencies are pondering new rules that could allow more of it to come to Texas. The story was written by Aaron Douglas of the Texas Tribune. To get rid of 8 gallons of water, the U.S. Department of Energy spent $100,000. It's little more than half a tank of gasoline in a mid-sized car, but the radioactive shipment from South Carolina to a West Texas company last fall marked one change that could lead to more nuclear waste traveling to Texas, waste that, until recently, was considered too dangerous to be disposed of. Much of the public debate surrounding waste control specialist hazardous waste facility in Andrews County on the New Mexico border has focused on the company's plans with a partner to store the riskiest type of nuclear waste, the spent fuel rods from nuclear power plants, which can remain dangerously radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years. Scientists agree that spent nuclear fuel should be stored deep underground, but the U.S. still hasn't located a suitable site. Interim Storage Partners, a joint venture of Waste Control Specialists and Orano USA, a subsidiary of one of the world's biggest nuclear power companies, proposed bringing the spent fuel to a 332-acre site next to the WCS facility in Andrews County until a permanent storage site is found. If the plan succeeds, it would be a big expansion for waste control specialists, which has been disposing of the nation's low-level nuclear waste, including tools, building materials, exposed to radioactivity for a decade. Interim Storage Partners' website says it expects to get the federal approval for spent nuclear fuel storage, a major step in the plan, this year. The idea still faces significant legal hurdles and stiff opposition from environmental groups, local oil companies, some residents, and Governor Greg Abbott, who wrote to federal regulators last year asking them to deny the license application, stating that the proposal presents a greater radiological risk than Texas is prepared to allow. The federal government and the companies involved say radioactive spills during transportation or storage that expose people or the environment to radiation are very unlikely to occur, but opponents fear human error, mechanical failures, or geological changes could result in groundwater contamination. But while the slow-moving plan is wrapped in political turmoil, lower-profile changes and proposals from federal agencies are giving waste control specialists another avenue to accept more radioactive waste than it does today. The wastewater that traveled from an old South Carolina nuclear weapons facility more than 1,000 miles in three truckloads in late September was an example. It was the first shipment made after a 2019 U.S. Department of Energy decision to reinterpret how different levels of radioactive waste are classified, allowing it to be disposed of at a commercial facility. The decision lets the DOE categorize waste based on its properties and hazard level rather than how it was created, and allows radioactive waste from nuclear weapons production and government-sponsored nuclear energy research to be shipped to commercial sites such as the one in Texas, rather than indefinitely stored at a government site. Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, December 11th. Bobby Ray Derryberry Moore died February 4th in Temple, Texas. Bobby was born on April 25th, 1926 in Lorain, Texas, to John Errol Derryberry and Madge Alden Taff. She married Olin Moore in 1945 in Midland. Bobby worked at the First National Bank of Midland for many years. She is preceded in death by her husband, her parents, and six brothers and sisters. She is survived by her daughter, Vicki Jackson, son, Tommy Moore, granddaughter, Erin Jackson Robertson, and two grandsons. She is a former member of the Golf Course Road Church of Christ. Susie Molina, age 39, passed away on February 8th. She was born in El Paso on February 2nd, 1982, to Carlos and Bertha Molina. She moved to Midland as an infant and grew up to graduate from Midland High School in 2000. She was preceded in death by her confidant and mother, Bertha. She is survived by her father, Carlos, son, Caleb, grandmother, Soledad Castaneda of Denver, and numerous relatives and friends. Arrangements are under the direction of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home of Midland. Visitation is set for Saturday, February 13th, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and a rosary at 7 p.m. Due to COVID concerns, the funeral home will close from 12 to 1 and 4 to 5 for sanitation. It is requested that people vulnerable to COVID-19 send their prayers from home. Interment of ashes and mass will be announced at a later date. Coy Wrigley Alvarez, age 2 months, of Midland, passed away on Monday, February 8th. The family will receive friends on Friday, February 12th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Celebration of Life will be held on Saturday, February 13th, at 10 a.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welch Chapel. Coy was born on December 13, 2020, to Jessica Martin and Jacob Alvarez in Midland. Coy is survived by his parents, as well as his brother Cayman Alvarez of Midland, his brother Jet Alvarez, and his sister Zayla Alvarez, his grandparents Mark and Becky Martin of Ballinger, his grandparents Ricky and Becky of Goliad, his aunts and uncles Jeremy and Bridget Tidwell of Midland, Mark and Samantha Martin of Midland, Scott and Jenna Rivera of Ballinger, and Max and Haley Knight of Goliad, his numerous cousins. Coy is preceded in death by his great-grandparents, his great-aunt, and his cousins. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Frank Norwood Jr., age 93, of Midland, passed away February 9th. A celebration of life will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, at First Baptist Church Chapel in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Leslie Prince, age 58, of Midland, died Sunday, February 7th, in Midland. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. February 12th at First Baptist Church, with Darren Wood officiating. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Funeral Home of Midland. Melissa Sue Williamson, age 57, of Midland, passed away on February 6th in Midland. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Friday, February 12th, at First Assembly of God Church in Odessa. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home in Odessa. This is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 11th. Estranged mom pushes closer after first grandchild's birth. Dear Abby, my mother and I have never been close. We talk to or see each other 5 or 6 times a year at family functions. Honestly, I am fine with this. I recently had a baby, her first grandchild, and suddenly she wants to come over all the time. I have tried to set boundaries, giving a day and time when she may come over, but it makes me look like a bully, and she tells people she doesn't feel welcome. My issue is she struggles with boundaries. She asks about my finances, inappropriate questions regarding my pregnancy, etc., topics I don't feel comfortable discussing with her. I honestly don't view this as my problem. We barely have a relationship and haven't for a long time, so I think she should take what I am offering. I simply do not care to see a lot of her. If she wants to see the baby, I feel I must be present because her having time alone with the baby is not an option that will work. Should I feel bad that she doesn't feel welcome? Signed, It's Complicated. Dear, It's Complicated. I am sorry you weren't willing to share what caused your estrangement from your mother because it would have given me more to work with. Assuming there is a good reason for it, which I am, your mother is correct about what she's telling people. She isn't welcome. In fact, she's quite the opposite. If she doesn't know the reasons for it, you should make them clear to her. Because you are hearing her complaints repeated by others, feel free to explain to them the reasons. You are within your rights to set boundaries regarding your mother's visits, and you should not be made to feel guilty for doing it. Dear Abby, I have known my friend Isabella since elementary school. When we were teenagers, we both developed medical problems. I tried to help her as much as I could, but it became clear that she was having trouble dealing with her condition. She was headed down a bad path and struggling emotionally, so we gradually grew apart. I friended her on Facebook because I still wanted to remain friendly, but she never posted anything until recently. Now she has started posting about heavy drug use and how much it helps her. I don't want to be associated with this. I am building a career, and I don't want anyone assuming I use drugs too. However, I want to remain friends with Isabella on Facebook, since it's our only method of communication, and I want to help her overcome this. What do you suggest? Signed, Discreet Helper in the South. Dear Helper, I'm suggesting you unfriend Isabella immediately for the reason you mentioned, the fear of guilt by association. As much as you would like to help your old friend with her addiction problem, and while you might suggest she enter a treatment program, it won't happen until she finally realizes that the drugs are not only not improving her life, but preventing her from accomplishing it. From what you have written, Isabella is still neck-deep in denial, and you cannot fix that. Here is today's horoscope, Royal Stars by Madeline Aslan. The stars show the kind of day you will have. 5, dynamic. 4, positive. 3, average. 2, so-so. 1, difficult. A baby born today has a sun in Aquarius and a moon in Aquarius. Happy birthday for Thursday, February 11th. Helpful, inventive, and appreciative, you improve life for others. This year, you follow your ideals and pursue a project close to your heart and succeed tremendously. Allowing others more privacy really pays off. If single, you're very attractive, so you draw many, but you decide to stay mostly single this year. If attached, you're very involved in your partner's life. Bliss and passion are yours. Sagittarius is a free spirit. Aries, March 21st to April 19th, 5 stars. Friendships and group affiliations get you involved in an array of new interests. Politics and humanitarian values are a prime focus. Those who lack confidence and experience welcome your kind words and courtesy. Tonight, love and appreciation surround you. Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, 2 stars. Established patterns change slowly. Old memories are haunting. Let time be a healer. Patience with elderly people and authority figures is essential. At work, much is expected of you. Others rely on your skill. Tonight, you realize that a part of the past must end. Gemini, May 21st to June 20th, 3 stars. Today is a time to be conscientious and generous. Don't let others think for an instant that you would take them for granted. When it comes to individual beliefs, allow others to search for their own truth. Tonight, don't turn a conversation into a sermon. Cancer, June 21st to July 22nd, 4 stars. Today allows you to purge old financial debts or dilemmas. Others ask you for financial help and advice. Old conditions and stale goals are waning. This is a truly death and rebirth trend. New realities replace old attitudes and priorities. Tonight, you're aware of interconnections. Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd, 3 stars. Partnerships are growing. Others want commitment from you. Encourage others to communicate. Conversations and emails help you explore the parameters of important relationships. Moderation is the best policy to adopt. Tonight, make every effort to understand and respect the views of others. Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd, 2 stars. It's an emotionally charged day. You're expressive and especially sensitive. You can treat an old illness or establish a more wholesome daily routine. Pets are especially important. They provide a new level of comfort and companionship. Tonight, others are preoccupied and distracted. Libra, September 23rd to October 22nd, 5 stars. Today brings delight in the company of younger people. A child you're close to seems very grown up. Past obligations melt away. It is easier to enjoy the present and to plan for the future. Tonight, planning for the future. Scorpio, October 23rd to November 21st, 4 stars. Comfort factors at home are in your thoughts. You would relish a roomier, improved residence. You could seek a new apartment or schedule home improvements. Tonight, there is a new aura of love and contentment coming into your residence and family life. Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st, 5 stars. Today brings clarity and focus. You have self-confidence and marvelous persuasive talent. Enlist support and seek information. Your word skills are in top form. You produce impressive writing and speak eloquently. Tonight, follow through with future travel opportunities. They are there. Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th, 4 stars. You will enjoy a new perspective on old puzzles and problems. It is easier to view bittersweet memories with appreciation and to understand why certain situations occurred. Abundant calls and emails. Tonight, reach out to an elderly family member who has been lonely. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th, 5 stars. Today outlines your options and illustrates what is most important. Your mental attitude and concern inspire others to seek your advice. A group discussion is especially fruitful in providing information and ideas. Tonight, celebrate yourself. Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. 3 stars. Today, you cherish time alone. Seclusion brings peace. Subtle mystical energies are coming into play. Secrets tend to come out. You may have to cope with an exposed, vulnerable feeling. A meticulous approach to details wins you admiration. Tonight, relax. Born today, inventor Thomas Edison, born in 1847, singer Sheryl Crow, born 1961, actress Jennifer Aniston, born in 1969.
Hello, this is Cindy, continuing to read from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday. U.S. Post Office, Downtown, 100 East Wall Street, 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Village, 2315 West Louisiana Avenue, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Graves, 3304 West Wadley Avenue, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday. Claydesta, 612 Veterans Air Park Lane, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. GMF Midland, 1000 Loop 40, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. How sick are you? Midland Memorial Hospital offers a nurse triage program, 68 Nurse. The program is designed to help people determine whether their health situation warrants a trip to the emergency room. Midland residents can call the line by dialing 686-8773. The program is free and available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Local nurses are available to help you determine the best place to receive care for your situation. 68 Nurse can help you save time and money by directing you to the most appropriate health care option whether it's a neighborhood clinic, urgent care center, emergency room, or just staying home. Know a member of the military coming home? Military families can call 352-0785 or email Vicki Gomez at zemogv@cable1.net when they know their member of the military is flying into Midland International Airport, so the Permian Basin Welcome Home Committee can be there to greet them. Honor those who served. There are many organizations in operation right here in the Permian Basin that are at the task of serving all kinds of needs for present and former members of our military. Some of them are Show of Support, 687-2167, Honor Our Troops, 889-0177, Real Thanks, 528-6633, Centers for Children and Families, 570-1084, Midland College Veterans Affairs Office, 685-4511, Permian Basin Welcome Home Committee, 366-3458, Soldiers of Today and Yesterday, 631-3429. COVID positivity rate down to lowest since at least July. The Midland Health Department reported Wednesday that only 7.7% of those testing for COVID-19 at Midland Health Centers this week are testing positive. Those 33 positive tests are through Tuesday. However, if that percentage continued, it would be the lowest percentage for a week, going back to at least the beginning of July. The low positivity mark during that time is 8.1% during the week of September 12th. The City of Midland did report two more COVID-19-related deaths Wednesday. One was a female in her 30s. The other was a male in his 40s. Both had underlying health conditions, according to the city. The man passed away Monday and the woman on Tuesday. Midland Health also reported that 15% of all inpatients inside Midland Memorial were active COVID patients, tied for the second lowest percentage this month. The surgical region of the state, that includes Midland and Odessa, posted a 6.31% occupancy rate, the third lowest percentage of all regions in Texas. City enjoys a sales tax collection rebound, by Stuart Doreen. There was a decline in the city's February sales tax collection, but the $4.897 million collection was nowhere near the 20% declines during 7 of the 8 previous months. The City of Midland reported Wednesday that the sales tax collection fell by 4.32% in December compared to 1 year earlier, but the percentage still broke trends during a COVID and oil price-induced economic downturn. First, there was no 30% decrease like the city experienced during the previous 2 months. Second, there was no 20% decrease that was the constant during basically every month going back to June. Third, the city had reported double-digit percentage declines in 10 of the last 12 months heading into February. The one trend that continued was that the number of months was a sales tax percentage decline increased to 14. February's collection represents spending that takes place in December, so it is typically one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of the year. The $4.897 million collection would have ranked as the third highest of 2020, behind February of last year, $5.118 million, and May, $5.004 million. It was the fourth highest collection for a month of February in the city's history. The city has collected $20.26 million during the fiscal year. That is 17.46% or $4.235 million behind the pace set during the fiscal year 2020. Opinion. Our view. Landlords need help after the boom period? Apparently so, by Stuart Doreen. It was strange reading the Reporter Telegram story that the city will create an assistance program for landlords hurt by the pandemic. For years, landlords set the price, any price, absolutely sticking it to renters of rooms, apartments, or homes. There are many of us who believe in the free market, but still shook our heads. Not everyone works in the oil field, we would tell ourselves. Those in government held their hands up, since it wasn't government's role to set a ceiling or provide assistance for renters facing outrageous rents. They were right, but it still was frustrating to see it happen to people I worked with. Now we hear there is potential for people who stuffed their pockets full of cash for years to have the city, read here taxpayers, to bail them out. Okay, here's the thing. Not everyone who will ask the city for a few bucks to allegedly pay their property taxes took advantage of the system during the boom periods of the last decade. And yes, tenants have rights that make it tough to send them packing during the COVID period. But this is still a tough sell for this longtime Midlander to take. How do we prove who still has someone in their property who can't pay rent? How do we prove that the same landlord could have filled the room with someone else? Will officials get to see the money made in the years prior to COVID? Why do I have to bail out someone who went property hunting at all? There are saving graces. First, apartment owners aren't eligible. Second, the council instructed city officials to look for a way to create the program without using CDBG funding and to establish guidelines for participating in the program. If city planning staff determine it's not feasible, the program will not move forward. Maybe they will determine it is impossible to determine who gets money and who doesn't. Again, these optics are brutal living in a community where rents were jumping 30% year over year and affordable housing wasn't reality. Maybe there is a legitimate need. It is just hard to imagine when the rent for the average apartment in Midland was $1,600 a month, the highest in the state, less than 24 months ago. Victim status is just difficult to imagine.
Commentary from the Houston Chronicle. Cancel the in-person STAR. Schools get a pass. Kids should too. After nearly a year of an educational environment pulled apart by a pandemic, many are at the breaking point. Now the state of Texas is adding to the load. We struggle to understand the trade-off in priorities, accountability over safety, that has prompted the Texas Education Agency to insist that all students report for in-person STAR testing and that high school students pass end-of-course exams to graduate. Our questions to the agency went unanswered, but TEA owes Texas families an explanation. Even in an ordinary school year, the merits of the STAR as an accurate measure of learning are debatable. When instruction has been fractured and uneven, a standardized test cannot be a fair barometer. How can it pinpoint learning gaps without taking into account the wildly different levels of instruction children are receiving or the impact of compound traumas on scores? It is foolhardy to proceed with the STAR, especially since this year the test will not count towards school accountability. School administrators get a pass, but kids don't. Forcing students to take the test in person, adding to their stress and potentially exposing them and their teachers to a deadly virus, seems counter to the priorities of safety, flexibility, and parental discretion that have thus far guided state policies. The stakes for high school seniors, those in virtual classes who don't show up for the exams, may not be able to graduate, seems needlessly callous. Miguel Cardona, President Biden's pick for Secretary of Education, alluded to that during his confirmation hearing on Wednesday. If the conditions under COVID-19 prevent a student from being in school in person, I don't think we need to be bringing students in just to test them. Fact is, the blanket testing mandate on public schools across Texas doesn't take into account the varying degrees to which districts and schools are adhering to safety protocols, or the fact that one exposure is enough to contract the virus. There are vigilant parents who haven't sent their children back to in-person classes because they distrust, often for good reason, the commitment of local school officials to take COVID-19 seriously. The state is allowing districts to set up satellite centers that will accommodate testing while maintaining strong public health practices. Districts can also apply for waivers so students not scheduled to take the STAR could learn remotely, freeing up space for test takers to social distance. But so far, TEA has not specified any coronavirus prevention measures during testing. And what about the time and resources needed to set up alternate testing sites or the impact on districts whose budgets are already tight? We're in the middle of a life-threatening pandemic, State Representative Alma Allen from Dallas said Wednesday at a press conference where Texas House Democratic Caucus members called for the cancellation of the in-person STAR. We also cannot ask our teachers or our school personnel, students, and families to put themselves to risk for an unnecessary test. Let me emphasize, unnecessary. Educators don't need to a test to tell them what is known. Many Texas students, grappling with cascading pandemic stresses and disruptions, are struggling. Failure rates are up. Attendance is spotty. Kids are experiencing high levels of depression and anxiety. Those considerations are why State Senator Jose Menendez of San Antonio has filed a bill to cancel this year's STAR, and why a growing number of states are requesting federal waivers to cancel their own standardized tests. The Biden administration extended the deadline for waivers, but needs to act decisively by granting states permission to forego the tests, as the Trump administration did last spring. Last March, Governor Greg Abbott made the wise choice of canceling STAR tests, noting then, "Your health and safety are top priorities, and the state of Texas will give school districts flexibility to protect and ensure the health of students, faculty, and their families." At the time, Texas had only recorded one death from COVID-19, and compared with the current toll of 2.4 million cases and more than 37,000 deaths. While it is true that Texas and the world have learned a great deal about the coronavirus in the past year, including how to prevent it, its continued spread and worrisome mutations show we still have a lot to learn. Abbott should keep health and safety as top priorities, far above a faulty barometer of statewide student performance, made even less effective by erratic variations in instruction this past year. Great risk plus questionable benefit equal one responsible choice. Cancel the in-person STAR. Innovation in the Permian Basin is taking place at UTPB. The Permian Basin is blessed with valuable natural resources and an entrepreneurial spirit that makes it home and a destination for people who are willing to take a chance and do something big. University of Texas Permian Basin has the honor of working with people and businesses in this region to bring the ideas to fruition, ideas that continually better this greater community and future-proof our economy, always building on our solid foundation in the energy industry. At UTPB, we embrace the Wildcatters spirit. To this end, the support of Midland Development Corp and Odessa Development Corp are being leveraged to make the UTPB campus the center for entrepreneurial and advanced workforce skill development for our region. The ultimate goal, to nurture ideas that grow the economy in a stable, sustainable way. We'd like to share how our partnership with visionary leadership in the Permian Basin allows us to deliver on one of our university's four strategic pillars: serve the region. UTPB is serving the region with innovation and workforce training through multiple projects on our Midland campus at the Center for Energy and Economic Diversification, Incubator and Makerspace, access to managerial training, office space and support for startup businesses to have low-cost access to the tools they need. This is a place where entrepreneurial spirits will push the envelope with innovative projects. Texas Water and Energy Institute, dedicated research to deliver methods for efficient use and reuse of produced water. Advanced Manufacturing Center, combining workforce training and applied research to provide technology and advanced manufacturing and machining to the Permian Basin. Small Business Development Center, which last year helped raise $28 million for small businesses in the Permian Basin, supporting more than 3,000 jobs. UTPB Engineering and MBA programs, bringing technical and managerial talent together where big ideas get launched. Only 8 miles away on UTPB's Odessa campus, any emerging entrepreneur can access these programs. Innovation Center, gaming and performance stages, Blackstone launched pad by Techstars, academic centers. The Office of Innovation and Commercialization can direct the entrepreneur straight to the research center with the tools needed to move forward. Locating these related services in the meeting point of the two largest communities in the Permian Basin improves access to the technological tools and industry connections that are necessary for entrepreneurial innovation in the modern age. The physical spaces provide opportunities for the scientists, the creatives, the managers, essentially all the entrepreneurs in the Permian Basin to interact and leverage their talents together, bringing new ideas to enhance the quality of life for all who live here. We look forward to seeing you on the UTPB campus very soon. Midland College honors winners of Creative Writing Contest from Staff Reports. Shaquila Sarapau won first place in both the essay and poetry categories at the Rebecca T. Watson Creative Writing Contest with her essay, An Immigrant's Daughter, and her poem, Anatomy of the Human Body. On January 27th, the Midland College English Department hosted the Rebecca T. Watson Creative Writing Contest Awards Celebration via Zoom video conferencing. Awards were presented in three categories, essay, poetry, and short fiction. Zane Calley won first place in the short fiction category for Cycle of the Mind. Second place winners included Bailey Munoz for The Darkness, Halima Badru for Misdemeanor, and Harley Swiney for A Comedy to Some, A Tragedy to Others. Third place went to Evelyn Martinez for My Grandfather's Encouragement Makes Me Feel Closer to My Heritage, Luis Buceno for This Time Last Year, and Logan Whiteman for Black Ice. Fourth place and honorable mention awards were given to Elizabeth Brown, Sarah Brumley, Miriam Falana, Camilla Justice, Lexi Pate, and Desiree Tobar. MC began the Creative Writing Contest in 1975, and in 2012, the contest was renamed in honor of a retired MC English professor, Rebecca Watson.
This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Feds Still Working on Future of Bush's Boyhood Home, by Ken Herman, Austin American Statesman. Today we have some news about a former Austinite's former home. Like many of us, he's not a native Austinite, and the former home in question is not in Austin. Unlike many of us, the federal government is involved in the future of this former Austinite's former home. Uh-oh. From 1951 to 1959, young George W. Bush, then ages 5 to 9, lived with his family at 1412 West Ohio Street in Midland. It's a humble, comfortable home that's now owned by George W. Bush Childhood Home, Inc., a nonprofit that preserves and runs it as a museum. The house's future, however, remains in question and is the subject of a process by the federal government, bless its heart, that began in 2012 and is currently in a phase scheduled to end in 2022. Quick math. Young Bush lived in the house for 4 years. The federal government, in one iteration or another, has been reviewing its possible future for 9 years and counting. Yes, says Jacqueline Wolf, interim executive director of the George W. Bush Childhood Home, Inc. The bureaucratic process takes forever. I have wondered why President Bush didn't authorize the site addition via executive order before leaving office. But it's fine. We're not impatient about it. The timeline. In 2012, then U.S. Representative Mike Conaway, Republican Midland, and former chief financial officer for Bush's Arbusto Energy, Inc., asked the National Park Service to conduct a reconnaissance survey of Bush's childhood home to evaluate it as a potential new unit of the Park Service. As sometimes happens, one study begat another. In 2015, the survey produced a decision that, quote, further analysis, unquote, was needed via a study that needed congressional approval to get underway. So, in March 2019, Congress okayed the John N. Dingell Jr. Conservation, Management, and Recreation Act, which, among other things, directed the Secretary of the Interior to conduct a special resource study of the Bush childhood home. Let's pause here to acknowledge the West Ohio Street Little House's special place in U.S. history as the former home of two presidents, George H.W. and George W., two governors, George W. and Jeb, and one first lady. FYI, the Midland home the Bushes moved into in 1955, prior to moving to Houston in 1958, is in private hands. So now the good people at NPS are doing the special resource study to determine whether the home meets the criteria for becoming part of the National Park Service system. That included a January 26th virtual session with background and updates about the home and the process. During the session, Project Manager Carrie Miller of the Denver National Park Service Office said we're now in the public outreach and input phase that ends February 28th. So feel free to weigh in. And if the process goes as planned, Miller said in the online meeting, we will finalize the study findings at the end of 2022 and submit the completed report to the Secretary of the Interior for his or her consideration. Once approved, the Secretary will transmit the study to Congress. She also noted that Congress can act anytime it wants. So can the President, who has unilateral authority to designate places for inclusion in the Park Service system, which now has 423 units, including the LBJ Boyhood Home in Johnson City. If they don't take action, Miller said of Congress, it's possible that nothing will happen as a result of this study. The home is now on the National Register of Historic Places and carries the State Historic Landmark designation. Wolf said the house gets 6,500 to 7,000 visitors a year when there's not a pandemic. The nonprofit supports the home becoming part of the Park Service system, which, Wolf told me, long has been Laura Bush's vision. Seems like a good idea. It is well run now, Wolf said, but we want to ensure that future generations care for it as well as it is cared for now. The NPS online meeting ended with a few questions from reviewers, including the one that Miller said was a good West Central Texas question. Would NPS assume ownership of both the surface rights and the mineral rights of the site? To be determined, but probably just surface rights, Becky Renas of the National Park Service said in the meeting. A Bush footnote, one that reflects both how long it's been since he was our governor and how Texas, maybe more specifically the Texas GOP, has changed in the years since then. This comes from Alberto Gonzalez, who was Attorney General in the Bush White House years. The question came recently from CNN's John Berman. Do you think that you could be elected right now as a Republican or win a Republican primary right now in the state of Texas? Gonzalez was elected to the Texas Supreme Court in 2000, having been appointed by Bush to fill a vacancy in 1999. Gonzalez, you know, John, I would worry about that, quite frankly. And I sometimes wonder to myself whether someone like George W. Bush could be elected statewide. If you get a different last name, based solely upon his principles and his politics, could someone like George W. Bush be elected in Texas? I would like to think that he could, irrespective of what his last name is. But yes, I do worry about that. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, Questions Around a Minimum Wage Are Complicated. One idea currently getting a lot of attention is increasing the minimum wage to $15 per hour. A wage floor is an artificial impediment to the smooth functioning of the labor market, but one with some justification. It's complicated. In a country rich in natural capital and human resources, the adoption of a minimum wage is a matter of choice. In making this decision, the U.S. opted, beginning in 1938, not to be globally competitive in certain low-wage sectors and to build our economy around certain higher value-added industries. The vast majority of Americans concur with this approach, and the results speak for themselves. The challenge is to get it right. The proponents of a $15 universal minimum wage, who are predominantly well-intentioned but misguided, often cite the notion of a living wage. This concept has merit, but ignores salient facts. Slightly over 2% of the workforce, and only 1% of full-time workers, are paid at or below the minimum wage. Many of these employees are teenagers, retirees supplementing their incomes, or secondary earners. For the economy to work properly, wages must be generally tethered to productivity. There are key sectors, such as hospitality, which could not support an increase of this magnitude. An unfortunate outcome of a $15 minimum wage would be fewer jobs available for those that the measure is designed to help. There are very real problems associated with the working poor. But more than doubling the minimum wage is not the solution. Similarly, there are substantial variations in the industrial compositions, educational levels, and cost structures around the country. A $15 minimum may well be appropriate in some areas, but not all. The Texas economy could not absorb an increase of that magnitude without disruptions. Some level of minimum wage hike may well be warranted. It's been over a decade since the last adjustment. The U.S. raised the federal minimum wage in 2007 to 2009 from $5.15 to $7.25, which seemed to work well and was not an impediment to the recovery from the Great Recession. One reasonable approach could be adjusting to the same level of purchasing power as in 2009, about $8.75. Periodic recalibration helps to assure that the underlying objective is maintained. Different areas of the country could continue to make adjustments compatible with their economic structures and priorities. Finally, as noted, there are valid reasons to reassess the minimum wage, but a stimulus bill is not the proper vehicle. Minimum wage changes are a poor stimulus mechanism. They are diluted and occur only gradually. The purpose of a stimulus package is to immediately juice the economy, and funds should go to individuals and firms that will quickly spend them. As I said, It's complicated. Stay safe. This column was written by M. Ray Perryman. M. Ray Perryman is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Perryman Group.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.